Not had enough of me yet? Well, good news. You can now listen to William Hill's Upfront with Simon Jordan podcast right here. The series, hosted by me, gives you a front row seat to big name interviews discussing their career successes and failures. Sit back and enjoy.
Did you enjoy playing for England?
No, I never enjoyed playing for England for the simple fact is I never played enough. I always find myself defending myself.
But you've got to on this one, Rob. You've got to, because you hand it to him, round it up in a little bundle and said, there you go.
But that was me winding him up, or trying to wind him up.
So if you were being kept out of an England squad by a player that was playing in the Saudi Pro League, you'd be pretty pissed off, wouldn't you?
Of course I would, but I'd also be pissed off if I was kept out of the England squad by players who weren't playing for the club. This might get a little bit of a thing, this, but Michael was quicker than me.
Yeah.
But every other element of being a striker, I genuinely think I was better.
This is Upfront with me, Simon Jordan. I believe there are a lot of vacuous, uninformed, unchallenged opinions out there. I want to get to the bottom line and cut through the nonsense. So with this podcast with William Hill, I'm going to get people with strong views who think they can stand them up to proper scrutiny. There's a good chance I might learn something along the way. And more importantly, so might you. Joining me in today's episode, a local Liverpool boy who quickly became a club icon at Anfield, nicknamed God amongst his own fans, forging memorable strike partnerships beginning with Ian Rush and ending with Michael Owen. He currently stands as the Premier League's eighth all-time scorer with 163 goals along the way. And his time in football hasn't stopped as he swaps the pitch for the dugout. Robbie Fowler, welcome to Upfront.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to see you, mate. Robbie, in these podcasts, when I'm talking to you guys, you elite sportsmen, one of the first things we do is try and get an understanding of their background.
Okay.
To understand what made them and where they came from and what went underneath the bonnet to create this elite sportsman. Now, your background was obviously Toxteth.
Yes.
People like me will know Toxteth. Early 80s with the Toxteth riots, and that will be an ignorant point of view because I'm sure it's famous for other things than just the Toxteth riots. But that was your background, and that's where you came from. So walk me through what created you.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. I think when people talk about Toxteth, from, you know, certainly from where I was from, I mean, it wasn't the most well-to-do place, but you know, it's literally probably about a mile from the city centre of Liverpool, and I'm a real Liverpool lad. Bit of a tough upbringing. You know, my mum and dad had split up. I'd never really lived with my dad, you know, and I'm not going down the realms of I want everyone to feel sad for me about my upbringing. My upbringing was brilliant. I was still close to my dad. I was very, very close to my mum, but I lived with my mum. So my upbringing was probably slightly different than the average family, I should say.
Was football for you a way out of perhaps not the most ideal circumstances?
I mean, I know what you're saying and I can get it, but, you know, I can see it now. If I go back into the start of my life or the start of my football career, yes, I can see that. But when I'm playing football, you know, there was no chance I was thinking this is a way out. Right. I mean, I played football because I loved the game.
Yeah.
I was forever playing football in the schoolyard. I was forever playing football. You know, when I get home from school, I lived in Masonettes, and where I lived, there was lots and lots of families who, you know, different age groups. So. I was playing football from 4 or 5 years of age, you know, against lads who were, you know, 12, 13, 14. So I think that shapes you more than anything in terms of becoming a better player. If I was to sit here and say, you know, I wanted to play football because I wanted a better life,
yeah,
I mean, I would be far from the correct answer, because I genuinely never thought about it. I mean, I was so lucky to have played the career and had the career I had, you know, got paid well for it, but I was lucky because I was getting paid for my hobby.
Yeah. But you made your own luck, though, didn't you?
Of course, you know, I think anyone will tell you, any sports person will tell you, you know, you need a little bit of talent, but you need a lot of luck along the way as well.
And a lot of mental fortitude and resilience, yeah.
I think that's probably one of the things that I'm probably good at. I think the mental side of my game is very good, the mental side of me. And I probably, the older I've gotten, you know, certainly when I was playing in games for Liverpool and other clubs, you know, I think that separates, you know, the weaker players from the stronger players. If you're mentally tough, I think you can probably adapt to certain situations better. And I think I was quite good at that.
When you say weaker players, I'm not asking you to name any players, by the way. What does a weaker mental attitude look like on the pitch?
Well, I just think it's heightened, you know, when the times are tough, when you're having bad results, you know, when you need players to stand up. It's shown for the ball, yeah. and trying to be an example. I mean, we've all seen players in the game, you know, and obviously no names, but when times are tough, you know, players hide behind others. So all of a sudden, when there's a pass to be on, you know, a pass to be had.
They look like they're available, but they're really not.
But they're not. Yeah. You know, they go a little bit quiet. Yeah. And, you know, I don't think I was ever like that. You know, I'm quite confident on the football pitch. You know, I'm quite confident in and around the football environment. Probably because I loved what I was doing. You know, and I never really felt any pressure doing it either.
But am I right that were you a boyhood Everton fan?
I was, yes. Right. All my dad's family were Reds.
Right.
Except my dad, who was a Blue, and all my mum's family are all Everton fans and still Everton fans now. Right. But I was brought up with mum, so I'm going to obviously congregate to that side of the family. And I used to go to the games. I mean, my favourite players growing up were obviously Trevor Stephen and Graeme Sharp.
Right.
But you can imagine Liverpool and Everton in the 80s when I was growing up. The football was brilliant. Yeah. And I was never sort of a bitter Evertonian where I couldn't stand Liverpool. You know, I was never one of them. I mean, I appreciated good football, but at that particular time, you know, Everton were as good as Liverpool.
Indeed.
You know, they were in the 80s. And I was playing for Liverpool Schoolboys. Now, Liverpool Schoolboys, as you probably know, is obviously no affiliation to Liverpool Football Club. And when you play for there, you get all the scouts from from all the football clubs. And the first scout that come up to me was a scout called Jim Aspinall, who's sadly no longer with us. But he was the one who spotted me, and you know he was he wanted me to ply my trade at Liverpool.
And what were you then? Were you a goal scoring machine? What were you? Were you a young star?
Yeah, I mean, I was a goal scorer. Yeah, I wouldn't go as far as the machine because. I was okay, you know. Was I the best player? Probably not. In all fairness, we had a player called Tony Grant who went on to Everton. Never had the career I had, but growing up, he was far better than me. Obviously, our careers went obviously different paths. He went Everton, I went to Liverpool. He was probably the main player.
Because it would have been a big thing to have been picked up to go to Liverpool in '89.
In fact, it was probably a little bit earlier, in all fairness, probably 87, 88.
Because they'd been in their pomp then, wouldn't they?
Yeah, yeah. But it's one of them. So when you're a kid now, and I think football is different now where you get picked up for academies when you're four, five, six years of age.
Right.
Whereas I think we had two coaches for the older age groups, three coaches. One was Steve Iwai, who's an absolute Liverpool legend.
Brilliant player,
yeah,
and a great coach as well, yeah.
Very good, and a fella called Ewan McCauley and Dave Shannon, and I think back now, and I'm like, I can't imagine the amount of work and the amount of effort they put in for trying to make so many good players, because you know you look at academies now, and there's 30, 40, 50, 50 staff, and at the time we only had three of them.
We have Michael Owen here, and. Not suggesting that Michael Owen was being big-headed and that you're very self-effacing, but he was very, very specific about the fact that he had no doubt that he was going to be the best player. And that not necessarily...
Well, he wasn't when I played, was he?
Well, I'm just saying what he said, mate. but he had no doubt that he was better than everyone else, and that, you know, that his route was clear in his own mind. Yeah. Were you on that page?
I mean, before I left school, I mean, I was not bad in school, in all fairness. I was in all the top groups, but before I left school, I was guaranteed a one-year YTS, which is obviously a one-year apprenticeship, and a three-year pro. So I knew I was going to be a professional footballer. Yep. Now, whatever level I was going to get to, I mean, that was up to me after school. So I knew I was going to go down that route. I mean, I knew from a young age I wanted to be a professional footballer, never wanted to be anything else.
Did you have any backstops in your mind? Was it priced in? You've got a one-year YTS with a pro contract on the back of it, right?
Yeah.
But if there was this, if the worst had come to the worst, did you have any thought processes that anything else was on the horizon for you?
Absolutely no.
No, this was it. Shit
or bust. No, it was football or nothing.
Yeah.
And I mean, suppose I'm one of them. You know, if you're that focused, and you want something, and you
go after the outcome.
You've got to put everything into it, and you know that's the way I was. So I was so visionary in terms of
so,
you know,
blinkered on it.
I wanted to be that footballer. Now I know what Michael's saying in terms of. I mean, I remember Michael coming through, and he you could see Michael was was a different class compared to all the other players. Now, I'm not saying I was like that when I was a kid, but I was scoring goals from a relatively young age. You know, I never scored and I never played, you know, hundreds of games in reserves. I was more or less frustrated to the first team. So, I mean, I sort of done my apprenticeship in the first team, you know, in all honesty.
Baptism of fire, which might be better.
Yeah, that's not a bad thing. You know, it's sink or swim.
Absolutely. I think that works in a lot of aspects of life. I mean, he talks about having a natural talent for goal scoring, and I'm not going to do. I'm promise you, I'm not going to do many too many compares and contrasts between you and Michael Owen, right? But notwithstanding it, you two were in the same space, playing for the same club, both renowned goal scorers. But did you fall into the camp of a natural goal scorer? Because it seemed to me he was very very casual about it. Yeah. It was very easy to him. It came naturally.
Yeah, no, I mean football came easy. Obviously, but it came easy because I practiced, and I've done all my pro my coaching badges, and I done a thesis on my pro license. And it was about the nature or natural aspect of professionals, you know. And I'm a massive believer in nature over nurture,
right?
Because I'm a natural believer in nurture over nature.
Yeah, I was gonna say,
because I think all of us are generally born with something, you know, we are, but
getting out
you need something to get out. And this is probably what annoys me about sort of my career. And, you know, I have it all the time. Even now people go, you're probably one of the most naturally gifted goal scorers. But I worked hard. I mean, I genuinely worked very, very hard. And I mean, I was so focused in terms of what I wanted to be and what I wanted to do. I mean, I was kicking balls and left foot, right foot. I mean, when I was first started playing, I genuinely couldn't use my right foot. I couldn't do it. But I practiced all the time.
Why would it annoy you that people make this assumption? Because those that know, don't they?
Yes.
And of course, those that are valuable opinions. But you made the point that it annoys you that people naturally assume that natural ability and it's not hard work. You know.
Yeah.
And your outcome is the end product. So why would it irritate you a little bit?
Because I want people to know that I've worked hard. When you talk about natural ability, you know, people say, you know, you're playing because, you know, you're a natural goal scorer.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, for me, that's not right because I worked at my
game. It undermines the application that you put in to get to the level that you're at.
Exactly, and I worked hard. And I mean, every single day I was going home, you know, practicing.
Yeah.
And you become better at doing so because the repetition, the monotony of doing it over and over again.
Yeah.
And that's probably where the natural ability or the natural...
Well, you bring out the natural ability, you enhance it, don't you?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Walking into a Liverpool dressing room, what, 17 years
17,
of age?
17, I think.
Irrespective of how dominant Liverpool are, and the Premier League is just starting, isn't it? I think it's the first season, isn't it? What was it like? You're walking in, and I went to Liverpool. I went down to the boot room, tiny little room that is, sat with Sammy Lee, looked around. You know, it's a massive football club. And you as a 17-year-old kid, walk into this environment, getting your baptism of fire, as you describe. What's it like walking in there with these figures of reputation and this club of stature?
The way you put it there, and I mean, I never looked at it like that.
Didn't give
way.
It a thought process.
No, because I mean, I knew how big Liverpool was. I knew how big the players were. I sort of understood football. I knew how good they were, but I was so confident in what I could do. So I was more focused on me. So, I mean,
did you feel you merited to be there? Didn't feel any intimidation about it at all.
I did. You know, obviously with the games and the goals, and never ever felt overawed or never felt I shouldn't have been there. I mean, I probably got to a point when I was first starting where I probably wasn't ready. But then, you know, the more you train with him, then, you know, and this is why I love Graeme Souness, actually, because he was like, you know, he was man enough to, I'm not sure whether he can say that anymore, can you? Or he was person enough to...
You can, mate.
Can we?
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, so he was man enough to, obviously, to put me in. And I loved that about him because he knew I was ready. And whether I thought I was myself, I didn't know. But, you know, thankfully I've gone in a team, and I think there's a difference between confidence and cockiness.
Yeah.
And I was confident, but I was never cocky. You know,
cocky's a bit arrogant, isn't it? It's a bit ignorant as well,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, and that's one
confidence
thing.
Confidence is different, isn't it?
That's one thing I've never been, to be fair. I think I'm...
it's belief in yourself. But you know, when you start projecting onto other people about how good you are, then people can categorise, and you don't need to. If you're good, you're good.
Yeah, right. I'm all for that. Yeah.
Talking about Souness, I'm very fond of Graham and spend a fair amount of time with him and speak to him about his time at Liverpool and levied the accusation that he had the most unproductive time in terms of he's one of the Liverpool managers with the worst records. which I know he doesn't like, and of course he's very proud of that football club, yeah. Values it very highly. I mean, obviously you'd have been young, and you might have seen some of it and not been oblivious to others.
Yeah.
When you reflect upon that, what do you look at it like now?
You know, was Graham a visionary? In terms of football in the UK, probably was. Our football at that particular time probably wasn't ready. Mm. So I do get the instance where people think he came in and tried to change it too soon. But what Graham is trying to implement is exactly what every football club does now.
Mm. Which is ahead of his time.
I think so. Yeah. It was hard for players to sort of get into, because, you know, I look at Ian Rush and think, he's the best goal scorer I've ever seen. So if he has a drink, it might work. Yeah. So I come into that culture as well. So I'm not saying I was old Eden Dower and never drank. But I drank, you know, because that was what we did, and that's what the culture I sort of come into football was all about. And if it worked for them, and all of a sudden you think, well, if you've got to try and change your attitude and your mental aspect to do something that you've not necessarily done before, but you've been doing it this way because you've won everything that the club's got to offer, and then all of a sudden you've got to change, it's hard to adapt.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think probably even Graham now would accept himself that he wasn't fundamentally wrong in the principles of professionalising the football club, preparing it for the next generation of opportunities in football where the game is changing.
Yeah.
But maybe slowly catching monkey, right?
Absolutely.
Carragher talks about, Jamie Carragher, about the perceived responsibility of local boys playing in their side. He used Marcus Rashford as an example and what's happening at Man United and the players not stepping up.
Yeah.
But did you feel that having come from that particular area that you felt there was a greater obligation or responsibility upon you to do things in every game and every opportunity?
I never felt it amongst the fans. I always felt, I had a real good affinity with the fans because of where I was from.
Yeah. We don't get called God for nothing, do you?
Well, I mean, I've been called lots worse.
Well, God's not a bad one, is it?
It is, actually. But yeah, I think the fact is that, you know, I always looked at it and I think the fans always seen a little bit themselves in me because of where I was from.
Yeah.
And they probably seen this local kid done good. And, you know, I think that's probably why they always talk to me. And look, I do get certain people, you know, whether it's Jamie Carragher, it's Michael Owen, and they can talk about, you know, playing for, you know, for these clubs and, you know, understanding what it means from a fan point of view. But it never materialised with me.
Do you think he's wrong, though, in the assertion that there's almost an... I think the underlying observation was there's an inherent responsibility for players that understand the value of the football club, come through that football club, get it and what it means to people, that they would carry a greater burden of obligation.
Do
you think he's wrong or do you think he's right?
No, I think he's wrong for me.
Yeah,
but because right I never worried or, you know, thought about that. Other players might do so. I mean, what's right for me is not necessarily right for other players.
Yeah.
And I do get it. Everyone goes into a different game with a different attitude, a different mentality. But it wasn't for me. I mean, I appreciated it. You know, not saying anyone else doesn't appreciate it. I appreciate it because I got on well with the fans. And I think the fact is that I sort of knew if I went out there and played the way I could, then, you know, there wouldn't be a problem, you know, per se with me.
Obviously, you have this remarkable start to your career. I mean, irrespective of scoring 6 goals in your first 3 or 4 games or whatever it was, 3 seasons of scoring 30-odd goals, right? I would say that in today's society, that might be considered what top strikers do.
Yeah.
But in your time, you know, a goal in every 2 games, because I made the observation to Michael Rowan about being bland by scoring 1 goal in 2 wouldn't get him to win the Ballon d'Or in this day and age, and he told me that the players of his generation were much better than the modern-day footballers.
I agree, but you know what you're saying? Go back to what you're saying there, Simon, as well. You know,
do you agree with Michael's observation that you guys, in your period, were better than the players now?
Yeah.
Why?
Because it was my period. That's simple. I mean, what you were saying there before about what Michael winning, you know, scoring 1 in 2. Now, you probably wouldn't win the Ballon d'Or with that nowadays. I get that. But you also mentioned the fact is that, you know, players score 31, 32, 33 goals, you know, a year. I mean, I'd done that as a young kid.
It was remarkable.
No one's done it since. So,
no, I know they haven't.
So, you know, that for me, that's an incredible achievement. And when you think about football and you think of lifestyles from where we are now to where we were when we played, I mean, football has changed. There's no doubt about it. I mean, the game's probably quicker. The players are looked after better. But that's not a slant or, you know, on what we were doing, because we done what we needed to do. And if we were to adapt to the culture of today, we do it. I think we as players, I think we were technically very, very good. We might not be as fit as, you know, some of the players. But if you put me in the game today, I mean, I have no doubt, and I would score more goals.
Given that, and also the adoration of the Liverpool fans, I mean, you don't get called... I mean, Matthew Letizia got called Le God at Southampton, but with respect to Matthew, Liverpool's on a different level to Southampton. You're getting called God by Liverpool fans, and you're revered. Why didn't this translate into England?
The genuine answer is I don't know, because I mean, I'd scored almost 100 goals before I got my first cap.
I mean, what do you mean to that?
I think it's extraordinary, in all honesty. I genuinely think it's a little bit of a head wrecker.
So who would have been the coach? The Taylor?
No, it was after Graeme Taylor. So
it would have been Venables?
Venables, yeah. Venables, Glenn. Obviously given it my... So Glenn Hoddle, Terry Venables, Glenn Hoddle.
Sven,
yeah. So they were
in your pomp, when you're a flying machine, you know, and you're scoring 33 goals, 30-odd goals a season in the first three seasons, today and age, you'd be in the England squad like that.
Absolutely, yeah.
Why do you think that is? I mean, I know there's players around, there's Shearer, there's Sheringham, there's Wright, there's Ferdinand, there's Cole, but you'd put yourself up with those guys, wouldn't you?
And genuinely, I would back myself to be better than them all. You know, that's obviously me and obviously my belief and my confidence in myself and what I could do. In terms of goal scoring, I was probably the best at the time. You know, I'm not saying I was playing in the best team by any means. I never had a team that was built around me, what other players did. But when you think of sort of England teams...
Were you talking about Blackburn or Shearer?
Yeah, I think teams. And obviously other teams, you know, possibly right here, you know, Arsenal as well. You know, and there's other players, and I'm not having a go with them.
You
know,
no, you're just making an observation.
It really doesn't concern me, to be fair. And I mean, what concerned me was the amount of goals I'd scored and I still couldn't get a look in. Now, you think back and think, well, it's probably wrong. But being a manager now and being a coach now, you think, if you're a manager and you're comfortable with certain players in certain formations or certain players in certain roles, then you're going to go with that. You know, and at the time, it's hard to take because you think, well, I should be a given, I should
but
be
it's a... But it's more than one manager, though, isn't it? Right? You're smashing it, yet you're not getting the opportunities. And it's not just one England manager. It's two or three England managers. Do you think it's anything about you? Do you think there's anything you could have done differently? Is it anything about perception? Because I know that there's issues where you feel that perceptions of you are not always where they should be.
I got 26 England caps, and it was probably a few months ago when I was sort of delving into obviously my England career, and I only started 11 games, and out of the 11 games, I only finished four of them. So did I get a probably
much of a
decent chance?
Yeah.
Probably not, in all fairness. And I mean, people can make it out what they want, you know.
But what do you make of it? People can make of it what they want, but it's more important what you make of it.
Yeah, well, what I make of it is that the managers at a particular time thought other players were better. You know, and that's the simplicity of it. You know, I can sit here and I can cry and I can, you know, I can pour milk on anything. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that that's what the managers were thinking. I don't agree with it. You know, and I still won't agree with it.
Did you enjoy playing for England?
No, I never enjoyed playing for England for the simple fact is I never played enough. When I played, of course, you know, I did love playing for England, but I always felt I was a bit part player. I always felt I was going to go down there and I was never, ever going to play. Now, I think anyone will tell you, if you're going down there all the time and you're in squads and you're never really getting a look in, it's a bit
demoralising.
It's more than a bit demoralising because the amount of goals I'd scored, you know, for my club. So I'm not saying that you have to have a defined right to go and start, you know, any game for England. But
you want a fair quit?
Yeah, I'd like to think that the games I did start and the games I did play, I'd done okay. But I mean, the fact of the matter, managers just thought other players were better. I mean, I can't speak for them other than that, Simon. In all honesty,
did it annoy you, irritate you, honestly here, that Owen seems to have been taken so readily into the England setup? You're playing in the same side. There is an element of the, and this is perception, mate, so don't get irritated by it, that Owen is eclipsing you. You'll probably see it differently.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah.
And he's in the England setup, and pff, it's lights, camera, action for Michael Owen. And it seems to me that you're becoming a little bit of an afterthought. Does that irritate you?
I mean, did I want Michael to fail, or did I want him not to do well? I wanted to get. Of course, I wanted to play, but I did not want Michael to not succeed.
I know you would. I'm not suggesting that you would. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying that. But I mean, I'm just talking from my point of view. I think, you know, players are sort of one dimensional in terms of looking after ourselves. We've always done that,
which is what you have to do.
You know, and I think that's probably why that is, I scored him out. Because you are a little bit selfish. Mm-hmm.
But, especially as strikers,
of course, and I think you probably need to be. In all honesty, but. If you think of a footballing person and you know the way they are and the way people's perception of them is, I think Michael's perception is he thought more of England than his club.
Yeah.
But with mine, I thought more of my club than England.
Yeah.
Now it could have been the other way around if I'd have played more
for
England.
Which would have endeared you to Scouse fans, because there is this Scouse mentality about England,
of course,
and the royal family and all that goes with that, isn't there?
The royal family is relatively new, isn't it? You know, I think if you go back as far as, I mean, you look at the cup finals in 86,
they weren't doing the national anthem.
No, not then. So I think that is a relatively new thing. But look, it is what it is in terms of football. You know, people can think what they want. I mean, I always thought I was better than Michael, in all honesty, even when Michael was coming through, you know, and I'm not sitting here being egotistical or being derogatory towards Michael. I think the only thing, and I mean, this might get a little bit of a thing, this, but Michael was quicker than me.
Yeah.
But every other element of being a striker, I genuinely think I was better. Right. Now, Michael can sit here and he can say exactly the same thing. But that is my opinion, and that is my self-confidence. I was better in every aspect of being a striker. You know, and look, that might come across as, you know...
Make sure for you, mate.
Egotistical, but...
Michael can look after himself, can't he?
Of course he can, and, you know, and I get on very well with Michael, in all honesty. But, you know, Michael will sit and say the same thing because he has that incredible confidence, and he played to the level he did because he was a great player.
I don't think there's anything wrong, Robbie, with having belief in yourself. If you don't believe in yourself, who's going to believe in you? If you believe, people will take those sort of words and twist them how they want, right?
Yeah.
But you say what you mean and mean what you say.
Of course.
And I think I've done things in my life where I've been better than other people. And sometimes I say it and sometimes I don't. Yep. In the context of the way that I'm framing questions, I'm almost making you say to some extent because I'm putting you in a corner and saying about Owen with this, and I think it's entirely fucking right that you turn around and go, well, actually, by the way, I think I'm this and I think I'm that. Talking about strike partnerships and talking about players that you've played with, I mean, you formed various partnerships with Ian Rush, with Michael, and with Stan Collymore.
Yep.
When you look back on those, which was the most enjoyable to play with, and is there a hierarchical structure in strike partnerships?
There probably is, in all fairness, now, in terms of how your team want to play. Now, I think of anyone will tell you who their best strike partner is the player that you score your most goals with.
Correct, yeah. Michael, is that true, though?
Yeah, I think so, yes, definitely. Now, my best strike partner was Stan Collymore. Now, I'm not saying Stan's the best player I've ever played with, but...
He was a good player, though.
Yeah, he was brilliant. He was brilliant. Now, in terms of players to play with, I mean, I thought Steve McManaman was unbelievable. McManaman was incredible. But in terms of strike partners, Stan was my best because I had my most fruitful time scoring goals playing with him.
Julier comes in 98. It feels like it's a different feel for you in that relationship. You get a knee injury, and that sort of keeps you out, doesn't it, for 97, 98. We discussed Michael bursting onto the scene and the 98 World Cup. And all that went with that. Whilst 98 is still some way away from your departure, you're beginning to move into the area where potentially you're coming to the end of your time at Liverpool. What was your relationship like with Julier? Because I get mixed perceptions of Gerard Houllier. Danny Murphy will tell me he's the best thing since sliced bread and absolutely adored him. I get the impression that that's not the same for you.
Of course, I think Danny will say that because he played under him. Any manager, I mean, we spoke before about England managers, didn't we?
Yeah.
Any manager you play under, of course, you're going to have a real good affiliation with. Now, what I will tell you about Gerard Houllier is he never played me, so you know, I disliked him for that. You know, right. I never got on well with him. But that doesn't mean I disliked him
as a bloke,
as a person, yeah. as a manager. You know, I genuinely thought what he brought to Liverpool was brilliant. Again, you know, we spoke before about Graeme Souness in terms of how he changed the lifestyle and the culture of that particular Liverpool team. Gerard Houllier done the same. And that was probably hard for me to adapt to.
But you do say in your autobiography that he lied to you.
Yes, he did. I mean, on more than one occasion, because he tried to sell me. Yeah. And when I confronted him, he denied it. So, yeah. I mean, I don't know what else to say because, I mean, you know, Gerard genuinely was a nice man.
Yeah.
He was. And I did fall out with him. I really did. But I fell out with every manager I ever played with. You know, and that's me.
Is that because, is that when you say fall out, is it your disappointment about not being picked at certain times? Is that it? Or yeah, was it personality clashes?
No, absolutely not a personality clash. I could not stand not playing.
Yeah.
I mean, that was...
If you think it should be, though,
yeah, I think if you think of the modern game, Simon, now you get players who are happy sitting on behind.
Yeah, that stinks.
I mean, that is wrong for me. Yeah. You know, I left Liverpool because I wasn't playing. And it killed me to leave Liverpool. And it's not being disrespectful to Leeds. It's not being disrespectful to Man City. I wanted to stay at Liverpool.
Yeah.
Now, looking back at it, I know you're a commodity. You know, yeah. And this probably what annoys me with the game now. So if you're looking at it from the outside, you know, the players get a lot of stick, don't they, about loyalty.
Yeah.
But loyalty is a two-way street. And it works from a club side of it as well.
Yeah.
So you know, the minute you're deemed not good enough, the club will get rid. So if it comes in the other way, it's... You know, the players are the ones that get all the stick. Now, I know you'll come back at me now because you're obviously an owner and a chairman and you've been that aspect, you know, you've seen that side of it, but you are a commodity. And the minute you're deemed not good enough, the club will ship you.
But won't you be deemed not good enough because of your own actions? If I sign you as a player and put you on a 3-year contract and pay the prerequisite costs of having a Robbie Fowler in my dressing room, your form deteriorates, you're no longer required... It's not because I devalue you because of your commodity. It's because you ain't doing your job. And so subsequently, you become less valuable to me. I suppose there's situations when the dynamic has changed and the club actually is in financial trouble and it wants to get you out the door and sells you for a certain perspective. But that ain't the case at Liverpool.
No, but if you look at the 2001 season, and I do get what you're saying there, and I understand that. And to a degree, I have to agree with you. But, I mean, I think back to 2001. Now, Gerard Houllier comes in... not comes in, but Gerard, who is the manager, and obviously his first choice was Emil Heskey and Michael Owen. But I'd like to think in that season, I more than done enough to help the team and achieve what we did. You know, it scored, you know, 18 goals without being a proper regular. So I never let anyone down. And I was still a good player. I was still scoring goals. But ultimately, a manager will come in and he'll play, you know, the players he wants to play. In my eyes, I'm still good enough.
Yeah.
But the clubs don't want you, so...
The difficulty on that one, isn't it? A little bit. Because if you're a proper club owner, you will allow your manager to have the freedom of expression to do what he wants to do.
Yeah.
If you're a busy bastard, you'll get involved and start involving yourself in the decisions. So if a manager doesn't fancy a player, it's not really the club owner's job or the club's job to step in and say, well, actually, we have an inherent responsibility to not treat him as a commodity and show some loyalty to him, when really it's the managers that make those decisions, isn't it, of which you are one now.
Yeah.
So it's not about commodifying something or making something a commodity. It's just about the reality of the world. You sign a contract with a club. You get paid. Sometimes you get paid for doing a not particularly good job, and sometimes you get paid for doing a brilliant job. And sometimes circumstances change and players get bought and sold. I think it's sometimes disappointing when players think that it's a one-way transaction, because I don't think it is.
No, I'm not saying it's a one-way. I'm saying it's a two-way street.
Yeah.
You know, the players, so loyalty for me is a two-way street. You know, if you deem not good enough, the club will quickly.
Yeah.
Now, I know what you're saying in terms of you're not scoring goals, you're not playing well.
Then you're not good enough.
Of course,
But it wasn't the case in your place.
But I was good enough, you know, and I was scoring goals.
When you look at your career, I mean, for me... When I speak to you and I look at your record and I remember watching the Liverpool side of the 90s, and I remember you, and I remember certain things that you did, and we'll talk about one of them in a minute because it always comes up, right? Yeah. And I'm not going to particularly dwell on the Spice Boys bollocks because I find that a bit formulaic and irritating. You've probably been asked it about 1,000 times, right? But I don't think you've got the credit that you should get, because even me, when I look at your goal scoring record, I think I don't remember Robbie Fowler being as prolific as that. I don't remember him being as clearly, because statistics don't lie, as compelling as he was. And I wonder how you look about it, because I think, is it fair to say, Robbie, that after your injury in 97, 98, you're probably not the same player?
Yeah, I mean, at the time, I'll be honest with you, I didn't think of that. It's only probably when you finish your career, you probably think, I probably wasn't the same player.
Right.
But I still scored goals.
Yeah.
I mean, but probably not to the point where I scored goals. And I mean, at the start of the show, you mentioned the fact is that I'm probably eighth in the all-time Premier League. I mean,
which is a remarkable stat.
Yeah. I mean, I genuinely proper proud of that.
So you should be.
And, you know, obviously I've not played the game for, I mean, my last game in the UK was probably 2007. 2006.
Right.
So it's a long time
15, 16,
ago for me to still be, you know, where I am. Mm-hmm. I mean, it shows you sort of how good I was.
Yeah.
I think my career could have been a lot better if it had probably looked after himself a little bit better.
What does that mean?
I mean, I went out and I was probably not professional the way you see professionals now. But that was me being culturally doing what was right at that particular time for what the players were doing.
You were a product of your times.
Yeah, exactly. The product of the environment, yeah. I think, I mean, I'd go out maybe a few times a week and it's just what we did. But I never thought it affected me, in all honesty. Now you can look back and look on your career, and the fact is that I maybe went out, that might have been instrumental in why I had so many injuries. You know, I mean, I've had, you know, I broke my leg, two ankle operations, knee operations, two hip operations. I suffered with obviously a bad back as well. So when I think of all that and still think of the amount of goals I scored, you know, I'm still genuinely proud of what I've achieved, but I could have achieved more.
I mean, it kind of leads me on, I mean, to an area where your image and the perception of you. And I think this is something that might bring not me personally, but I think it's something that brings the heckles up with you a little bit about people's perception of you. But they're saying you're a bit rough around the edges, a bit of a troublemaker. What do you think to that perception, and how relational do you think it is to where you are now?
Yeah, I think rough around the edges
sounds a bit patronising. I don't mean,
I mean
to sound
I think that's because of where I'm from.
Yeah.
In all honesty,
give this label the toxic terror.
Yeah,
and shit.
I mean,
like that.
The fact is that, you know, you throw in a toxic terror, just like it says something straight away, doesn't it? You know, and I know it's maybe a play on words because obviously you're terrorising defences, but other people mightn't see that. You know, other people might think, oh, he's from toxic. He's you know, a little bit, you know, rough around the edges, and he's a troublemaker. I mean, far from it. You know, I was brought up well. You know, I spoke before about, you know, my mum and dad not living together, but I'm always respectful. I've always been respectful.
But do you think, Robbie, I mean, again, do you think the goal celebration, you're going to have to answer to this one, right? Because you invited this one upon yourself, right?
Well,
you do a goal celebration where you're, you know, snorting a line of coke.
Yeah.
And I know you're going to say you're taking a piss out of Everton fans that give it to you, right? But they give it to you because they're creating a perception of what they perceive you to be, and you're playing into that stereotype.
No, it wasn't a perception of what I was. It was because it was rumours flying about Liverpool.
That's my point. Yeah, it's a perception.
So, yeah, but
it's not necessarily the truth.
It's not because anyone see me doing it.
I understand that. That's not the point I'm making. The people are, well, you know what football fans are. They'll use anything they can to get you off your game, right? But you going back at them with something that most people would say, you know, recreational habits are everyone's own business, right? And no one's suggesting you were involved in that. But you playing into that narrative will steer into the idea that people are going to say, Robbie, what kind of behavior is that?
Genuinely, it was me winding them up. Now, you talk about my career and, you know, I obviously went out, and because I could go out, and people think, well, I mean, he's out, he must be on this or is that. And the amount of people who see me do this, I mean, it's frightening, which is bullshit, because I genuinely never ever been involved, or, you know, never touched the stuff, and I wouldn't, because I spoke before about I loved the game, you know, and I didn't want to throw it away for being like an idiot, you know, and I never once thought, well, I'll give it a go, never once entered my mind. And people used to always say, oh, he's on this, he's on that. And again, I'll mention a little story about my dad come up to me once, and my dad said to me, listen, son, he said, you know, I'm hearing that many rumours that you're on drugs. He said, are you? And I went, Dad, I said, I can't believe you're asking me that. He went, sorry. He said, sorry, son. He said, I'll never ask you again. And it got to the point where everyone in Liverpool was thinking I was on it. And
why would they think that? I mean, just because you're out and about and a little bit larger than life?
I don't know, maybe. And I mean, I wasn't large in life, so I mean, I'm...
Because it's a shit categorisation, isn't it?
It's awful, yeah. And I mean, if you go into sort of any environment now, probably 90% of, you know, the people who are in a certain place are doing it now. Mm. I mean, I haven't played the game for years, and I could come out and say, well, yeah, I was, if I was, but I wasn't. And I always find myself defending myself.
But you've got to on this one, Rob. You've got to, because you're the one that did. I mean, I look at it and think, you're a far better player than that. You're far bigger than that. And yet you give it to them. You give them that opportunity. Yeah. You hand it to them, round it up in a little bundle and said, there you go.
But that was me winding them up or trying to wind them up. So it was a case of, user all saying this, you know, and I planned it.
But if you was a manager now, well, you are a manager now, what I'm talking about, and you have a player that did that, what would you say to him?
I don't know.
You would come up with you say, oh, don't be a tit.
Don't be an idiot. And look, there's a lot of things I've been proud of. And there's obviously a lot of things I haven't been proud of as well. Obviously doing stuff we're on a football pitch, but it's happened. But you know what? I'm a better person because it has happened. You know, it's made you probably appreciate things differently. It's made you sort of act differently. It's made you say different stuff. Now, I knew at that particular time, and look, I wasn't young, you know, let's not hide the fact that I was a kid doing it, you know, but I planned on doing it because it used to annoy me. And it was just a case of, can I swear? It was just a case of fuck you, you know what I mean? And that's what it was, because it was annoying. And everywhere I went, you know, I got tarnished and labelled with this drug taker. And even now, Simon, to be honest, I'll go on social media and people will mention it. And this was like, you know, I mean, we're talking 20, 30 years ago.
Management for you. I've seen observations, and I've made observations about you, about some of the responses that you've suggested, that you've not been given opportunities and that the opportunities haven't been afforded you. And I'm trying to work out what, like you just sat here, you're a serious man. You know, you've had a significant career. Perceptions don't last forever. But there must be perceptions of others. So, for example, I would say, what's the perception of Robbie Fowler in comparison with the perception of Wayne Rooney? Because Wayne Rooney is getting jobs at Derby County, going to MLS. So what's the difference in perception between you and him? You're having to ply, you're having to have boots and travel.
Yeah, I'm not getting into any conversations or arguments about why he gets a chance and I don't. I mean, I'm maybe different in terms of...
But I think it's important, because you're the one that says the one that says you're not given opportunities.
Do you think someone like him would and you wouldn't? But let me sort of lead on to what I'm going to say, Simon. So in terms of what you're saying, Wayne Rooney, look, you know, he's his own man. He's obviously chose his own path and he does what he wants to do. When I think about my career, I mean, I never had an agent, right? I had a financial advisor. Right. So I never... If I'm probably doing my career again, I would maybe think about having an agent, because you probably get more out of the game, in all honesty. So I think a lot of players do fall into the category of coaching and managing. Wayne Rooney done it because, you know, he fell into the obviously the Derby one. Obviously his agent was involved in that. The agency was involved in the DC United as a player. He goes back as a manager over there. And look, fair play to him, you know, what he's done.
Yeah, I'm not pitching you against Wayne Rooney.
No, I'm trying to work that out,
because you've said it. Not about Rooney and not about Lampard and not about Gerrard. Right? I'm not interested in pitching you against those guys. Yeah. What I'm trying to get to is why I do think you feel a little bit aggrieved about not being given opportunities. I saw a comment about you in the press about 2 or 3 months ago, and it came up with that you weren't given any opportunities. And my comments were, well, maybe if you stay in a job for more than 5 minutes, mm-hmm. and maybe if you've got a win record better than 15% in East Bengal, then maybe you can start having a conversation with people about what jobs you should have.
But yeah, you know what disappointed me about that is because you're involved with football, so you understand the elements of not everything is black and white. So you understand...
I was reacting to what I think had considered you whining about your opportunities.
No, not whining, far from it. You know, what I'm saying about, you know, when people ask you, have you had the opportunity? No, I haven't had opportunities the way other people have. But what I've done is I've shown people that I'm dedicated, I have the desire, the commitment to go overseas and do what I need to do.
That I'll give you.
Yeah,
but you're there for 5 minutes in each job.
But that's not my fault. You know,
but whose fault is it then?
Well, it's not mine, is it? So, I mean, I lost my... In Thailand, I mean, I took over a team. We were third in the league. We ended up finishing third and we got to the cup final. We lost the cup final after extra time, so I'd done a good job. Came home, wanted to do my badges and you know, wanted people to take me serious then.
Mm-hmm.
And then went to Australia. Australia was brilliant, you know, done ever so well. But COVID, that was entirely COVID. If it wasn't for COVID, we'd have won the league because we were by far the best team. And I was confident of that. So when I came home from Australia, you know, no one really knew what was happening in the world because it was a real bad time for everyone. Anxiety levels for everyone was through the roof.
I understand that.
Now, I knew I wanted to sort of get back in the game. Now, I didn't know what was going to happen with any other club. I didn't know what was going to happen. And then all of a sudden, I get a phone call would I be involved in taking a club from the I-League. Now, do you understand the infrastructure of the Indian League? I'm not being disrespectful.
No,
but,
I get the broad strokes. But
yeah, but it was obviously you have the I-League and you have the ISL. Yeah. So it sounds far-fetched, this, but when I say we had 10 days pre-season with a team built for the league below to go and play in the top league, it's probably akin to Accrington Stanley going into the Premier League with 10 days preparation. And we done well. So we finished 9th out of 11th. And it doesn't sound good. And I know it doesn't sound good. But it was a bigger achievement than what I'd done in Australia.
What kind of manager are you?
I think a very good one. I'm going to say that. I think I'm methodical in terms of how I want to play.
Yeah.
You know, I think anyone can sit here and say we want to play like Pep. You know, you can't play like because you haven't got them players. But I think I like to play on the front foot. You know, I like to play attacking football. But I'm also savvy enough to know that, you know, you've got to play a certain way because you don't want to concede goals. You know, as much as I am a goal scorer, I think you win games by conceding less.
Yeah.
So that's probably one of the things I've always done when I've sort of built a team.
Can you manage up, Robbie?
Yeah, look, I think you've got to in the modern game.
I think
that is the big thing, certainly at the minute. You know, you look at sporting directors, you look at technical directors, mm-hmm. and they're all coming more into the game. You know, they have been in for a while, but it's probably coming more dominant. So you need to speak. You need to speak to certainly owners, chairmen, sporting directors. Yeah. You know, even chief scouts now. You know, that's the way football is. And this is what I was saying before, Simon, as well. You know, I want to surround myself with the right people. Mm. You know, I don't claim to know everything on my own. And the day I know everything is the day I'll pack football in because, you know, that's I think it's impossible. I think you learn every single day, and it's important that you are that person who has that right people.
It's receptive to learning new things.
And that might be, you know, the people upstairs. I think that is massively important in the modern game.
But you have definite views, don't you? I mean, ultimately, if you're looking at where you are now, and we're going to get to talk about Saudi in a second, but when you look at the levels that you've managed at, where would you pitch yourself in England? If you were looking at an opportunity in England now, where would you put yourself? Would you, for example, you mentioned earlier on Accrington Stanley. Would you take a job at Accrington Stanley if they offered it to you?
I'm just look, without being, you know, derogatory or, you know, I want a job that has got a good project. Now, you probably hear projects all the time, but for me to go to a club, you know, and I'm not saying Accrington Stanley is this club, but for me to go to a club who have no ambition, I don't see the point.
Mm-hmm.
I'm exactly now as a manager as what I was as a player. I want to be the very best. And that's exactly why
but
I've
realistically,
I've done.
For you to get into English football, you know you're not going to land a Premier League job.
No, of
and
course,
you'd be
yeah,
fortunate, I think, to land a Championship job. So you would not... I'm not suggesting you should be targeting this,
yeah.
But a League One environment with a club that's got a little bit of ambition wouldn't be a bad place for you to land, would it?
Absolutely no. You know, of course, I'm sat here and, you know, without a job... So, yeah, you know, beggars can't be choosers at times, you know that. But I'd like to think that the place I've been, regardless of what people's perceptions of them leagues is like, you know, I know we're going to talk about Saudi, but in Saudi we had players who've played in the Premier League. We had, you know, six players who played at unbelievably high level. So I've coached and managed players who've played in the Premier League, you know, players who've played in the top leagues in Turkey, players who played in the top leagues in Germany. So it's not you're playing or you're managing these clubs and there's no players, there's no one of any stature. I mean, I'm talking about players who played at the top level at certain countries.
Yeah, let's talk about Saudi. in terms of, the media love it because it's the next existential threat to the Premier League. They're spending X amount of money, and of course Saudi Arabian investment into all sports, whether it's LIV Golf or whether it's the boxing world now. But first and foremost, it started with the Saudi Pro League and their ascension that might have been provoked by Qataris doing the World Cup, whatever, right? They've got more money than God, right? And they're going to utilise it, it would seem. You went there. Why did you think it was an opportunity for you?
Well, it was an opportunity for me because it was an opportunity. That's the simplicity of it. You know, it was a case I went over there as a consultant, in all honesty, and then just realised this club needed a manager. So I put myself down for it, you know, and got it. So
when did you, why has it come to an end, by the way, for you?
Just the sporting director had other plans. You know, he wanted to bring someone else in. And even that in itself, I mean, I was over there and, you know, my record over there is without signing statistically, it was brilliant.
Yeah, I can see it. It's a 6-7-5% win record, isn't it?
It was genuinely very good. But
you've got an insight into Saudi. I mean, it's the thing that everyone's fascinated about. I'm not particularly fascinated about it. I think it's just another country wanting to develop a football league, and good luck to them. As long as they don't fuck it up for everybody else and break the ecosystem and turn everyone else into economic ruin because they don't care about the consequences of it, I think chapeau, fill your boots.
But do you not think the Premier League done that, though?
I think the Premier League came out of the necessity to give English football a kick up the backside because prior to that, the economic landscape of football was in the toilets.
Yeah,
you know, we go through the 70s, we go through the 80s, and football is economically broke. Clubs are going bust, attendances are down.
Do you not think Saudi are doing what the Premier League done, though?
Yes and no, right? But the only reason the Premier League were allowed to do what they did because the de facto governance of English football, the FA, didn't do what it should have done, and the Football League were too stupid to take what was on offer, which was a significant proportion of the deal that the Premier League said to them. Well, listen, we'll give you, I think it was 25 or 30%. We'll give you 25, 30% of the revenues that we get. And the Football League went, no, we're our own fucking boat. Like, well, how did that work out? Mm-hmm. Now, go to your question with Saudi. There is no doubt in my mind, with all due respect to the Saudi Arabians, that are perfectly entitled to build their Football League and do what they want with it. There is an element of using sport as an image enhancer and a creative opportunity for attracting commercial attention to a country that would like to be an industrial hub, that would like to not just rely on what goes beneath the surface of the oil that flows through their community. They'd like to have other opportunities. So they don't have the same footballing motivations as the legacy football clubs that have happened in Europe. Right. So I think there is a similarity between the Premier League setting off into the sunset. But that's more to do with incompetence of other people that didn't jump on that boat and didn't see the opportunity than it is to do with potentially a nation state shaking up the infrastructure of football and changing the economic landscape and creating a problem that necessarily isn't for the betterment of football.
But with what the Saudi government are doing, are they not trying to do what maybe the EFL should have done years ago? They obviously want the football to be better.
Absolutely. And I don't think they should have any problems with investing significant amounts of money to give their leagues a chance. If they want to play at the table with the legacy football clubs, because whichever football club in Saudi Arabia is playing in a game, no one's particularly interested right now. They and I'm going to ask you about this because you've got the insight that people will be fascinated to understand because you've been there. If they want to be at the table with Liverpool, Manchester United, Barcelona, Arsenal, Juventus, Real Madrid, then they should have to be governed by the same rules.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And then if they can get their turnovers up to £500 or £600 million a year without artificially creating deals that enable them to do that, then they can have £300 or £400 million wage bills. Because my argument would be, none of the players that have gone over there, with due respect, would have gone over there if there wasn't a big bag of money on offer. Yeah. And surely Saudi Arabia wants to be a little bit more than just a big bag of money. Do you see some of the criticism that's been levied? Say one of your old teammates, Stephen Gerrard. What do you make to that? Can you see the criticism of Stephen Gerrard and find any justification in it? Because it looks to me like the only reason Stephen Gerrard's gone to Saudi Arabia is not because he wants to be a serious Premier League football manager or a serious manager, it's because he's going to get paid big bag of money.
Of course. And I said before, look, money talks and anyone can address it or, you know, wash over it however he want to. I mean, I can't speak for Stephen. I mean, obviously I can't do. But he's obviously got, I think he's gone over there because it's the opportunity again. Now, I spoke before.
What?
To get back in.
Do you really believe that Steven Gerrard going over, or any English manager that's trying to rebuild their career, goes to Saudi and it can be seriously considered as a gateway back into the top end of English football?
I mean, now that we're obviously talking about it, it's obviously tough, and we know that. We know how, you know, people's perception of Saudi is. But look, that might change. That might change within, you know, a year, 2 years. So, I mean, you don't know what's around the corner. Potentially, yes. I think it could be a bit of a ruiner. But also, potentially, it could be a good thing. If he goes over there and, you know...
Smashes it.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden you think, but wow. Because there's some... Obviously, we talk about good players, but some of the managers who potentially could go over there as well.
But I look at it and go, I can't, no. I don't look at Saudi and go, well, if a guy's been over there, I know what he's going to do. He's going to get me out of the Championship.
Yep. No, I get that and I see that. But, you know, when you talk about the long-term plan, and I know being a manager is probably far from anyone's fault, having the longevity to talk about what's going to happen in the future. But you've got to go over there and you've got to have the attitude of, first and foremost, I want to do well. So I don't think he's gone over there and gone, you know what, I'll do this to get back in the Premier League. I think he's gone over there, and I think for a player or a manager, it's for the now. You've got to go there, and you've got to do well, and that's the simplicity of
yeah. Because I mean, let's be fair. Irrespective, I mean, if he goes over there and makes a horlicks of it over there, he's done, isn't he?
But there's maybe an argument to saying, because obviously his record Aston Villa, people might say, you know, we wouldn't touch him anyway. So maybe if he goes over there and he feels as though he's got to reinvent himself to be the manager that he was maybe at Rangers, then, you know.
Do you think he'll make a top manager?
I think he possibly will be. You know, I like Steven. I like him as a person. I like him. I like him as a manager. Okay, you know, he wasn't brilliant at Aston Villa, and he will tell you that himself. But this is why that's important for Steven to go over there and do well.
It's also important why you take jobs at the right time. The reasons why I thought Steven, for what my opinion is worth, wasn't right for Aston Villa is because I think he needed to learn more, and I think the challenges at Villa were more difficult than he anticipated.
But I go back to Paul Ince when, you know, he took the Blackburn job. Yeah. You know,
and he'll say now, wrong time, wasn't
probably the wrong
enough.
Time. Yeah. But you know, if a Premier League club comes in for you, it's hard to say no.
Jordan Henderson, I think you've been defensive of him. I do think he's a hypocrite, because I don't think he needed to go out on a limb and make a four-act play of what his views were about particular communities. I don't think you can say the things that he said and be as supportive of a community and be so demonstrative. And I didn't respect the England players that went over to the World Cup and felt the necessity to tell everybody that they wanted to have a One Love armband until they get a fucking yellow card and then they don't want one. I mean, I've seen you've been defensive of him. Do you not see that there's hypocrisy in this position?
I mean, yes, of course. But you know, it's like, I mean, you said at the start of this, and I'm not having a go, you know, at Jordan for what his beliefs are or whatever. I mean, you said at the start of this, you know, you can potentially put answers into people by the question you ask.
Yes.
So I think where Jordan's probably gone wrong is because he's been a captain, you know, whether it's, you know, Liverpool, whether it's England, and he's been that leader. So, you know, you have things to say and people ask you questions. So,
well, keep your trap shut.
But maybe you can't. Maybe this is what
you can. Yeah, same way as I can. But, I mean, do you agree as a wiser man now, or as a man that's got control of his own thinking, that the idea of advancing political causes in football and sport is a good thing anyway?
Yeah, I think politics and football
shouldn't mix.
No, it shouldn't, because you become a role model without wanting to be one.
Yeah.
And I think that's just that's football in a nutshell. You know, people listen and people will take everything, you know, what you say not for granted is probably the wrong word, but people will take that, you know, and listen to it, whether they agree with it, whether they don't agree with it, but people will listen to what a footballer says. Now, should he be said it? Possibly not.
Do you think, with Henderson, that he should be playing in the England side because he's playing in a league that, you know, isn't at the top? You're not playing in competitive football on a week-by-week basis in terms of the levels that you should be playing at to play international football. Do you really think that he should be in an England side?
I think you should be playing for the England side if you're playing well.
By what standards?
Yeah, but it doesn't matter what standards. I mean, you look at the England squad now and the England setup, there's players within that squad who don't play. So, you know, can you throw that question at players who are not playing?
You mean Kelvin Phillips and people
well,
like that?
Well, yeah. I mean, Maguire was getting in the squad. And look, we're not having a go at players, but just regardless of whether they're playing for the clubs or not, whether they're playing great for the clubs or not, if managers are comfortable with certain players, then they're going to pick them.
True. But that wasn't the question I asked you. I asked you whether you think a player, put aside Jordan Henderson, put aside the allegiances you've got, and a player was playing in the Saudi Pro League, in a league that's a mile off the competitive leagues that we need to see our best players playing in.
Yeah,
come on, Robbie. No, I mean, you would say, I'm not having that.
No, but I mean, you can throw a few players into that mix. So you've got Henderson played over there. I mean, Ronaldo, regardless of his age and, you know, how good he's been in the past, he's still scoring goals for Portugal.
He's getting phased out, though, isn't he?
Of course. And Henderson will get phased out. You know, Benzema will get phased out. You know, that happens in football. Players will get phased out. Players, if they're playing now, and, you know, it's not my allegiances to Jordan Henderson, because I'm not unbelievably big mates with him. I mean, I know him, I've met him a few times, and I mean, I've got a lot of time for him, in all fairness. But
so if you were being kept out of an England squad by a player that was playing in the Saudi Pro League, you'd be pretty pissed off, wouldn't you?
Of course I would, but I'd also be pissed off if I was kept out of the England squad by players who weren't playing for the club.
Yeah. Last question for you. Would you beat Michael Owen if you had a competition of throwing apples in a bin? I think he's doing well in meme land at the moment.
You know what? Probably. I mean, what a question that is. I mean, I have genuinely asked.
I sat there and took when Michael was telling me, I sat there listening to it intently and seriously. I never knew it was going to be turned into a fucking thousand memes for poor Michael to live with.
Yeah, I know. Would I beat him? Yes, let's say why not.
Yeah. Listen, Robbie, I've enjoyed it today.
Pleasure, mate.
Look
Thank
forward
you.
To seeing you hopefully in the future in the dugout.
Thanks very
Thank
much
you for being so upfront.
Cheers, mate. Thank you.
Well done, mate. Upfront with me, Simon Jordan, is brought to you by William Hill. Future episodes can be found on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. 18 plus, please gamble responsibly.